We'll hear argument now, number 8864, Missouri versus Kalima Jenkins. Mr. Farmer, you may proceed whenever.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case is here on certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Petitioners are the State of Missouri and its officials found liable in their official capacity. We present two issues involving the attorney's fee award arising out of the Kansas City, Missouri desegregation case. The first is an 11th Amendment immunity issue, this time as it pertains to a Section 1988 fee award that includes prejudgment interest or compensation for delay in payment. The second issue concerns an issue that was also involved in the Blanchard versus Bergeron case, and that concerns the proper method of compensation for paralegal services. I'd like to briefly address the 11th Amendment issue first, and while the underlying facts in this case have been complex, only a few facts are relevant now. The Kansas City desegregation case began in 1977. The fee award, however, went to two groups of attorneys who entered the case later. Kansas City attorney Arthur Benson and his staff entered the case in 1979 and was awarded $1.7 million in fees and expenses for the period through June of 1986. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund entered the case in 1982 and were awarded $2.4 million. The plaintiffs became prevailing parties in September of 1984. The fee applications were filed in February of 1986. Fee awards were based on current rather than historical hourly rates. This was expressly done to compensate for delay in payment. Out of approximately 18,000 attorney hours compensated, about 85% were incurred in the years 1983 and 1984. The record shows that the current hourly rates used were approximately $15 to $20 higher than the historical rates for this period. Now, the 11th Amendment and the current status of the 11th Amendment is involved in at least two other cases before this Court this term. Pennsylvania versus Union Gas argued last October, and Gilhu versus Muth scheduled to be argued next week. The issue was also touched on briefly in Will versus Michigan State Department of State Police argued in December. The 11th Amendment has been explored in great detail in previous recent opinions of this Court. I'm not sure that I can add much to the detailed historical argument. In this case, it is the State's position that compensation for delay in payment or prejudgment interest is barred by the 11th Amendment, and we submit that the principles set forth in this Court's Library of Congress versus Shaw decision can be extended to an 11th Amendment context. Now, Library of Congress dealt with the fee-shifting provision of Title VII, and the federal government's sovereign immunity and the longstanding no-interest rule. Sovereign immunity was expressly waived concerning attorney's fees and costs, but this Court found that it was not waived concerning the sovereign's immunity from interest. We believe it can be extended to the 11th Amendment context because of the numerous similarities between the fee-shifting provision of Title VII and Section 1988. First, Section 1988, when enacted by Congress, Congress specifically relied on the language of Title VII, the fee-shifting provision of Title VII. The identical relevant phrase is found in both fee-shifting provisions. That is, quote, a reasonable attorney's fee as part of cost. In analyzing these words, this Court has already determined that they do not include prejudgment interest or compensation for delay. More importantly, the standard for finding a congressional abrogation of the 11th Amendment immunity is just as strict, if not more so, as the standard for finding a congressional waiver of the United States sovereign immunity.
But one of your problems, it seems to me, is to show that this no-interest rule attaches to state sovereign immunity under the 11th Amendment. You don't get to whether there's a clear statement or something like that until you find that that's an incident of the state sovereign immunity, it seems to me.
That's correct, and we believe it can be extended to the 11th Amendment because of the character of the element we're talking about here. Prejudgment interest or compensation for delay, or whatever term is used to describe the time value of money, is traditionally an element of damages. not cost. And the 11th Amendment immunity is protective of the state's liability from elements of damages. And that's the character of prejudgment interest is one of damages. We do not believe it's relevant that the Missouri has a general state statute that has been interpreted by state courts to allow prejudgment interest against the state. This is an action.
This is not really strictly prejudgment interest, is it? Couldn't one argue that what's at stake here is that there's no sovereign immunity, it's been decided for the liability for fees themselves, and the question is just how one measures the fee that's due given the delay in payment. There's no separately calculated item of prejudgment. It's just somehow or it's mixed up in the judge's calculation.
Well, it is mixed up in the judge's calculation, but it was separately calculated in terms of it. He specifically found that current hourly rates used were $15 or $20 higher than the historical rates, and that was done to compensate for delay. And compensation for delay is the same as prejudgment interest.
It's compensation. You don't have an interest rate factor. He doesn't say the interest rate is 6% or something like that. He just sort of uses a rough method of what he thinks is a reasonable way to come up with a fair fee.
That's correct. It is a rough method, but it's a method nonetheless to compensate for the time value of money, and it's to compensate for a period before the judgment. So therefore, it takes the character of a retroactive liability in that sense. Because this
is retroactive just since until the suit was filed.
Well, it's retroactive in the sense to the time the attorney's fees were incurred. Attorney's fees could be incurred before the suit was filed.
Is it your position that the attorney is fully compensated in economic terms when just the bare fee without any addition for delay in payment is the award?
Obviously, the fee is going to be a little bit less. The question under Section 1988 is a reasonable attorney's fee. And does a reasonable attorney's fee include prejudgment interest or compensation for delay?
Well, another way of saying it is a reasonable attorney's fee, in your view, is less than full compensation for the attorney's time reasonably expended.
But under fee-shifting statutes, attorneys are typically, the standard is not fully compensated. It's a reasonable attorney's fee. Attorneys in fee-shifting litigation.
So your position is that a reasonable fee is less than full and fair compensation?
No, Your Honor, that's... Our position is that a reasonable attorney's fee under the statute would not include prejudgment interest or compensation for delay. The policy reasons for including prejudgment interest or compensation for delay are reasonable. I concede that. They may be persuasive if addressed to Congress. Those policy reasons apply equally as strong in the Title VII fee-shifting statute, in which this Court found that reasonable attorney's fees, that also does not include prejudgment interest or compensation for delay.
Mr. Farmer, if you prevail in this case, do you think it would be permissible for a judge to follow a practice that sometimes masters would follow, to say require the parties to make a deposit to cover future liability for costs and then stick the money into an interest-bearing account to earn interest, and then if the state prevailed, they get the money back plus interest, whereas if the plaintiff prevailed, they could get their interest in that manner? Would that violate the 11th Amendment?
I think there would be serious questions involved in whether you could require the state prior to any judgment to deposit a certain amount in escrow to satisfy any future liability for attorney's fees. I don't think that would be proper. I don't think the 11th Amendment would allow for that. You're already requiring the state to commit funds it otherwise would have available for other reasons and to lock them away so they can't be
used. What if the state at the outset admitted liability and said the only thing we want to fight about is the nature of the decree, which is, I guess, what happened here in 1984. It was pretty clear there's going to be liability, but there was further litigation. What if at that point in 84 they said, we now know the plaintiff's going to be a prevailing party, and so there's going to be some liability for fees, so we'll ask the state to put up $500,000 in an interest-bearing account. What would be wrong with that?
Well, certainly the statute, I think Section 1988, allows for interim fees. That has been done in this case.
No, I say put it on the ground knowing there's going to be a lot of litigation over the form of the decree and things of that kind, in which end that the plaintiff is ultimately going to prevail because it's been determined he's a prevailing party. What would be wrong with saying that we know you're going to have to pay these fees, so we don't want the lawyer to work just wait for the money when he all this time, so it will require you to make a deposit. Why would that violate the 11th Amendment? And why is that really in substance any different from what's done here?
Well, in substance, it's different than what's done here because here there was no judgment on the attorney's fees until long after the liability order had been issued, and the judgment took into account the delay in payment. If immediately after the liability order, interim fees had been requested, certainly things may have proceeded differently in the district court. Requiring a deposit, I think, is no different than allowing for an award of interim fees, depending on the specific factual circumstances of the case. So since an interim fee award would not be barred by 11th Amendment, requiring a deposit probably would not be either. But I think the better practice would be to provide for an interim fee award pending resolution of the fees or the remedy, the scope of the remedy. In this case, this action arose under federal law, and we contend that the availability of prejudgment interest is governed by federal law. Just last term in West Virginia versus United States, this court unanimously held that the question of prejudgment interest is not controlled by state statute or local common law. A single nationwide rule is preferable to one turning on state law. Now, that case dealt with a claim by the federal government against a state and whether prejudgment interest could be awarded as part of damages on a contractual obligation. There, the states have no sovereign immunity as against the federal government, but the state is protected by sovereign immunity, the 11th Amendment immunity, as against private parties. We submit that this is simply a straightforward application of the principles in Shaw and that the 11th Amendment prohibits prejudgment interest as a delay or delay in payment factor. I'd like to turn now to the paralegal issue. The paralegal hours in this case were compensated at a market-based rate, and again, current hourly rates were used for delay in payment.
Mr. Farmer, may I ask whether you concede that recovery for paralegal services is included in attorney's fees recovery?
It's not necessary for me to concede that in this case. I recognize that.
Well, you didn't challenge that.
We did not challenge that in this case.
You just want to quibble over actual costs or market. So I take it that you must accept the fact that recovery may be obtained.
Well, to be honest, Your Honor, in looking at this issue in front of the district court, we litigated the issue that we felt we could win on. We did not think we could win on saying that paralegal fees were not separately compensable at all. I think a reasonable argument could be made to that effect. We are not making that here because I think the record shows.
Well, what is your position? Suppose the local market indicates that generally paralegal services are billed separately for legal services rendered in cases.
And I think that's what has been shown here. The record shows that the local market typically bills separately for paralegal services, so it's not included in the hourly rate awarded to the attorney.
So you do concede, in effect, that they are recoverable under those circumstances as a separate item on the bill for attorney's fees?
Under those circumstances, they could.
Why do you concede that?
Well, in this case, the attorney's fee, the market rate.
You're conceding, in effect, that when it says when the statute provides for the award of a reasonable attorney's fee, it includes not only a fee for attorneys, but for paralegals, too?
No. No, I'm
then what
not
are you
conceding? The statute includes attorney's fees, includes compensable items in two separate categories, attorney's fees and cost. If an item is not, if it is not an attorney doing work, then it's in the second category. If it's not included in the attorney's hourly rate, then it's in the second category, a category of cost or expenses.
And you're conceding that costs and expenses, as used in Section 1988, includes charges for paralegal time?
We didn't raise that issue in this
case.
Well,
but are you conceding it?
Well, I will not concede it as a matter of law. I think a reasonable argument could be made that it does not include.
Why don't you make it?
Because in this case, we felt the equitable resolution and under the particular...
Why don't you make it in this court?
Well, in this court, I will make the argument that the cost and expenses back in 1976 when Section 1988 was enacted, compensation, separate compensation or separate billing for paralegals was not a widespread practice. Therefore, an argument could be made, I think, that Congress did not consider
the issue separately. But, Mr. Farmer, could that argument be made in this case when it wasn't made in the lower court and you're seeking a reversal of the judgment?
That's why we are not making it in this court, Your Honor. We took the position in the lower courts, what we felt was fair and equitable under the specific circumstances of this case, and that is that the reimbursement for paralegal services should be under the actual cost method, not at a market-based rate.
What's the practice generally around the country, do you think? Are paralegal fees billed as attorney's fees?
Well, I think the practice varies. I think the prevalent practice is to bill separately. Mr. Topkus may be able to answer that better than I can, because I've spent my entire career in government service. Some attorneys do not. For example, the plaintiff's expert in the attorney fee litigation in this case testified that he did not bill separately for paralegal time. So I think the practice varies. The state of Missouri, we've looked at this issue very carefully and do not believe that using the actual cost method will increase fees or increase fee litigation. To begin with, law firms normally are not guaranteed an award of fees in any fee-shifting litigation. Therefore, they cannot afford to assign attorneys to do paralegal work just on the mere possibility that they will prevail and receive fees. Likewise, the most senior attorney in the firm is not going to be doing simple, basic legal research that a first-year associate can do on the chance that the higher rate can be recovered sometime down the road if they prevail. Law firm is going to continue to staff a particular case in the most cost-effective manner, in the most efficient manner. We do not think that this will result in additional fee litigation because of the scrutiny attorney hours and paralegal hours already exist. Courts routinely reduce the hourly rate or eliminate the hours entirely if, for example, senior attorneys are doing work that should have been done by junior attorneys. If junior attorneys are doing paralegal work, courts routinely reduce the hours or eliminate
the hourly rate. Can I ask a factual question? The district court referred to the paralegals that $40 an hour, and to law clerks at $35 an hour. Well, what exactly is a law clerk that he's talking about? You know? Is this a person not admitted to the bar and doing summer work, or is this a junior lawyer, or what? You know?
Well, the record isn't clear on that, Your Honor. The law clerk may be, in this case, someone who is not trained as a paralegal. The district court also included fees for recent law graduates who were not yet admitted to the bar who also worked on the case. The whole range of paraprofessionals that were not attorneys, basically I've lumped into one category of paralegals because that's what they are. They're not attorneys. They can't receive attorney's fees, so therefore the fee comes under the paralegal. Courts also routinely reduce hours or eliminate the hours if paralegals are doing clerical work that should be considered a normal office overhead. We also take the position that fee litigation may actually be reduced because the dollars at stake are less, and that thereby reduces the incentive to litigate the fees, particularly when everything you do in fee litigation just generates more fees for the prevailing party. Now, we concede that Congress was concerned about providing for reasonable attorney's fees, but there was also a concern in Congress that Section 1988 not result in a windfall to attorneys or become a relief fund for lawyers. Compensating paralegals at a market-based rate does result in a windfall, particularly in this case where the paralegals were hired specifically to work on this case.
Why any more so than compensating attorneys at a market-based rate?
We believe that the attorneys are treated differently under the statute. It specifically refers to attorney's fees, and therefore the attorney's fees get the market-based rate because that also includes overhead and a profit figure. The other category in the statute, cost or expenses, is treated differently.
So it depends on whether we treat the paralegal fees as attorney's fees or separately as costs, under your argument.
Separately as cost or expenses, that's correct.
It can't be an attorney's fee under the statute if it's for work done by non-attorneys.
That's correct, Your Honor. It therefore falls into the second category. And I'd like to explore this rationale.
Doesn't work by attorneys normally include an amount of overhead for secretarial services and all kinds of things that aren't work by attorneys that's incorporated in attorney's fees?
For attorneys,
what is this? Is it part of costs or part of attorney's fees?
Well, we believe it's part of cost and expense. It's an expense to the lawyer that he has to pay for in concerning the particular case. If I can give you an example, let's just take it one fine tiny step further. A legal secretary, like a paralegal, has specialized training, in some cases a college program. Is that also the type of expense that can be separated out and billed separately? And we're talking about billing separately here, not at an actual cost method, but at a rate 4 or 5 times the actual cost to the attorney. Now, again, this does not appear to be a widespread practice now. Maybe Mr. Topkus can address that. But the day may come when that happens. We don't believe that that kind of concept was considered by Congress in allowing a reasonable attorney's fees and costs and expenses under Section 1988. We recognize that it is one thing for a law firm to bill separately for those items on the basis of a contractual agreement with the client's consent. We're talking about fee-shifting statutes, which Congress has allowed the prevailing party to pass attorney's fees and costs and expenses on to one's opponent. With the concerns that Congress had about windfall, about providing for reasonable attorney's fees, we do not believe there.
Mr. Farmer, can I interrupt you a second? The judge in this case treated the paralegal time as part of the fee award. Were not the costs separately itemized and allowed things like transcripts and so forth? And the paralegal time was not included in what the judge called costs.
Well, yeah, it was not included in what the judge called costs, but it was included separately from the award that concerned fees. The interesting thing about that.
The judgment gave a big lump sum for fees, which had as a part of it all the paralegal hours and law clerk hours and attorney hours.
Pardon me?
Well, I thought there was one figure for fees for each of the two firms, which included the paralegal time and all that, and that the costs were a separate item covering things like transcripts and witness fees.
In the final recalculation or the summary, that's correct. But in listing that way, they were listed separately. The interesting thing about that is the cases relied on by Congress in enacting Section 1988, the one case, and only one case even referred to law clerk fees or paralegal fees, that is listed in a whole string of items of cost. It's listed separately from attorney's fees, and it's not in its own separate category. It's listed including the whole string of items of cost. So that's why we believe that in treating paralegal fees under the statute, it should be at an actual cost method.
Your position is that our decision will not affect the way attorneys use paralegals in their practice? In these cases?
We do not believe it will, Your Honor.
If you're wrong about that, then your position means that the cost bill or the legal bill may ultimately be more because attorneys will be used instead of paralegals.
That is certainly a possibility, but I think it's
a large part of your argument seems to rest on a judgment as to whether or not what we say makes any difference to the practice of law in these cases.
Well, one would hope that what you do say makes a difference in the practice of law. We do not believe that law firms are going to be treating paralegals any differently or staffing cases differently. To speculate that ultimately fee awards may increase, I think just cannot be shown from the record in this case and would be speculation at best.
Well, if attorneys are used in lieu of paralegals, then it clearly will increase the size of the awards.
Yes, but even now, those kind of hours are scrutinized by district courts in fee litigation. So if attorneys are doing paralegal work, the hours district courts now typically reduce or eliminate the hours entirely.
So you think there should be a legal requirement that paralegals be used?
Well, I think in determining whether to use paralegals or an attorney, the law firm must staff the case as efficiently as possible. In deciding what compensation to require one's opponent to pay, if a work could have been done by a paralegal but was instead done by a lawyer, then the district court should reduce the fee award appropriately. Just as now, if work is done by a junior associate or if work is done by a senior attorney that could have been done by a junior associate, courts routinely reduce those fee awards on that basis. Unless there are any further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Farmer. Mr. Topkus?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'd like to begin, if I may, with some comments on questions that were put to my friend Mr. Farmer in the course of his argument. First, in connection with a question that Justice Stevens put, I must advise the Court that there is no reference whatsoever in the trial court's opinion or in the record to any $15 or $20 differential between historic and current market rates for lawyers. I don't know where Mr. Farmer got that from, but he certainly didn't get it from the record here. The fact is that the state chose to offer no proof whatsoever as to historical rates, and now comes before this court and says, we want historical rates to govern. It seems to me that the state should have made up its mind some time ago. Justice Kennedy...
compensating for delay, wasn't there?
There was indeed, Your Honor.
And the judge did compensate for delay.
He said that he was taking, actually he divided his treatment between the way he treated Mr. Benson and the way he treated everybody else. Mm-hmm. In both situations, in varying ways, he did say that he was using current market rates and in consideration of the fact that there had been delay in payment. Mm-hmm.
So we just don't know how much compensation
exactly.
There was for delay.
That is exactly the situation, Your Honor. If I may, there is the sharp distinction between what the court did here, where he said, looking at everything, I think I have to take the fact that there has been delay into account, without specifying what account he gave it, and what happened in Library of Congress against Shaw, on which my friend relies, where the district court very deliberately set out to award 10% per annum by way of interest on its fee.
It's better or worse?
Better or worse for whom?
Well, you prefer the courts to say, well, I'm giving some indeterminate amount of interest here. I don't know quite how much it is. You think that's good, although if you said I'm giving exactly 10% interest, it's bad.
Well, I think I've got a two-pronged argument. As I'm sure Your Honor knows from our brief, we take the position that the 11th Amendment has no application here, and so on. But I think that it is perfectly reasonable to say, to draw the dividing line that Judge Ginsburg drew in Library of Congress against Shaw, where she said that if a court, where she said that she thought interest is bad, a flat award of 10% per annum or whatever is forbidden by the 11th Amendment. But taking the fact of delay in payment into account, along with all of the other factors appropriate for setting a fee, is permissible under she was speaking not of the 11th Amendment, of course. But we also see a difference between the 11th Amendment and the common law immunity of the states. The 11th Amendment of the sovereign. The 11th Amendment, of course, derives from one source, and the no interest rule derives from a very different one. Now, there's another point that I wanted to make in response to a question from Justice Kennedy. Your Honor asked Mr. Farmer what his position was. I'll make bold to tell the court what our position is. Our position is that reasonable compensation means reasonable compensation. We don't know, as I said, what the difference is between was historical and market rates. But let's suppose we were still in a time of 17-18% annual inflation, which we saw some years ago. Let's suppose that this went on for years. Would anyone call an award whose value was devalued by 40 or 50 or 60% because of delay reasonable compensation? I can't imagine it.
Yes, we would if the suit were against the United States. We've held that.
Held that it would be reasonable compensation,
well,
Your Honor?
The same provisions at issue here, if applied against the United States, would, according to our decision in Library of Congress, be held to preclude an award of interest.
Isn't that is true.
Correct?
In that context,
so that,
I certainly must agree
so
with
that
you.
Must mean that we're willing to swallow that very large camel, at least in the context where the United States is the defendant.
Well, I think perhaps if it came up before the court in those circumstances, the situation might be different. But I don't know. I don't attempt to forecast what this court will do. I just try in my humble way to influence it.
I'm just going by what we said in Library of Congress anyway.
Yes,
and the holding there
that.
Certainly does have that bizarre consequence that you just described.
And I suggest with all respect that the Library of Congress is not determinative here and that its rule, whatever its merits in that context, calls for no particular attention in this context.
Well, the principles may be exactly the same if we recognize state sovereign immunity.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm forced to agree with that. But if you recognized state sovereign immunity, you would have to recognize that you were departing from the roots, the bases, of the 11th Amendment. The 11th Amendment didn't come out of a concern.
Well, is that so? I think the 11th Amendment may have arisen out of a concern for state sovereign immunity, don't you?
With all respect, Your Honor, I would suggest that the 11th Amendment arose more out of a concern for the federalist system, a concern for the proposition that the states should not be called to account for anything in the federal courts.
Because the states were sovereign.
Your Honor may hold that view, and I certainly am not going to attempt to do other than put forward the view that it was not because the states were sovereign, having the mystical attributes of the sovereign, the king, the almighty, but because the states were federated, that they were independent entities coming together by consensus to form these United States of America.
They were sovereign states coming together in a federation.
Sovereign, yes, but not sovereign in the sense of necessarily possessing immunity. It was because the federal system would work best. That was Justice Holmes' phrase. It won't come to me quite. But it's important that the system work. We all know that. And I submit that the 11th Amendment was adopted in order to help attain that objective, not because of any mystical concern with the integrity of the king or anything of the kind, but because it was a deal. And the deal would never have been made. As so many historians have pointed out, the deal that was the Constitution of the United States would never have been made had the states not believed that they would never be amenable to suit in the courts of the United States. Now, there was, if I may pass to another point, there was lurking in the conversation while Mr. Farmer was up some reference to the time period that elapsed between the a decision on liability and the application for fees. I would accept no penalty for that, certainly, because the fact is that after the decision on liability was announced by Judge Clark, he said he was going to hold up on any fee award pending appeal of that liability decision, because until then he wouldn't know who was the prevailing party, and it would be a futile exercise to attempt to award fees. And it's significant to note that both sides consented to that treatment. Now, Mr. Farmer said that plaintiff's expert testified, and this is on the subject of paralegals. He said that plaintiff's expert, and he was referring to one of our experts, a personal injury lawyer from Kansas City named Max Faust, he said that our expert, Mr. Faust, testified that he didn't bill separately for paralegals. And that is the way the record reads. What Mr. Faust said was, I don't have any truck with that kind of fancy nonsense. I make contingency arrangements with my clients, 33 1/3% if I got to go to, pardon me, 33 1/3% if I settle, and 40% if I go to trial. That's enough for me, Mr. Faust said. It would be enough for most of us, I respectfully suggest. But in any event, he said also that whatever the practice of personal injury lawyers in Kansas City, he knew very well that the Kansas City law firms that bill on an hourly basis uniformly bill paralegals at $40 to $50 an hour, not at cost, but that $40 to $50 an hour was the market in Kansas City. The district court here awarded us the low end of that range. Another,
Mr. Tuckers,
yes,
if do you think paralegals come under the head of reasonable attorney's fees or under the other brand, under costs in 1988?
If I may, Your Honor, I would answer that question by saying that the overall thrust of 1988 is to put civil rights plaintiffs on a par with all other plaintiffs in competing for legal services, and that in consequence, their lawyers, if they are to have equal access to lawyers, their lawyers must be compensated as lawyers in other cases are compensated.
Are you going to answer the question?
Yes, I will, and I will say, in consequence, it appears to me that market should determine, because market is what determines in all other contexts.
Well, but I asked you a question which I don't believe you've answered.
I apologize.
My question was, do you think attorneys' fees are recoverable, rather paralegal fees are recoverable, as a part of a reasonable attorney's fee, or as a part of other costs?
I would say, with all respect, that I don't think it makes a great deal of difference.
Let's take reasonable attorney's fee. Now, you think that in addition to all the hours that the attorneys put in and their hourly rates, under the heading reasonable attorney's fee, one can then add paralegal charges?
I would be quite content to see that, Don.
And can you add secretarial charges, too?
No, because that's not the way the profession behaves. It seems to me that when Congress said award reasonable attorney's fees as part of costs, Congress said, the legislative history is perfectly plain.
Well, Congress said reasonable attorney's fee as part of costs. It didn't say any more, did it?
That is correct. That is correct. Nor did it specify costs item by item.
And you feel that a reasonable attorney's fee should include a fee not only for attorneys but for paralegals?
I'll take it there, or I'll take it as part of costs, but in either event, I want paralegals to be compensated on a par so that the plaintiffs, the civil rights plaintiffs, are not disadvantaged, because putting them on a par was exactly where the Congress meant to go.
Mr. Tompkins, it does make a difference to me whether you put it under attorney's fees or costs, because it is an impossible job to persuade me that you get costs awarded on some basis other than cost. I mean, I cannot go that far. When I ask you to submit your costs, I mean you submit your costs.
You mean out-of-pocket expenses.
That's what cost means.
That's what it does to me, too, Your Honor.
Well, so you really think it has to be under attorney's fees if it's going to be anywhere?
I would submit again
That is to say, if it's going to be compensated on market basis, if you were arguing, and that's all we're fighting about here. I can understand you're putting it under costs if all you're asking for is out of pocket, but if you want market, then I don't see how you can possibly get it under costs. So you're really left with getting it under attorney.
As a logical matter, I am of course in total accord with Your Honor, but the reality sometimes is a little different from logic, and the reality here is that you got to put it somewhere. And if you want me to pick somewhere, all right, I'll pick it as attorney's fees, but you could easily come back at me by saying, one thing we know about paralegals is that they're not attorneys. And...
Well, I don't deal with reality, Mr. Topkis. I deal with statutes.
I think better of Your Honor than that, with all respect.
I take it there is no instance, counsel, I take it there is no instance in which costs are billed in anything other than out-of-pocket?
Oh, I think there are many instances, Your Honor. Very frequently you...
What are those?
The statute allows you a certain cost regardless of what your actual cost has been. Usually it's less.
Well, is there any instance in which it's more?
I can't recall. I can't think of any. No. My argument on this point, to labor it, is the argument of parity. And if you want to single out civil rights plaintiffs and their lawyers as bearing a, as required to be some kind of lesser citizens, I don't think that's what Congress intended. Now,
even if the market would say that lawyers in this community do these cases on a contingency, you aren't required to recognize contingent fee arrangements, are you? Under 1988?
Not required to recognize them.
What if there's a 1983 damages suit and there's a recovery and the contingent fee contract would give the attorney twice as much as what hours times a reasonable rate would produce? Can you make the defendant pay that?
Your Honor has the advantage of me in being familiar with this Court's decision in the Bergeron case, which was announced this morning. But I would say that I think that a reasonable fee means a reasonable fee. And I can't really add very much.
No matter what the market says.
I'm sorry?
No matter what the market is in Kansas City.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, Your Honor, because it seems to me that what economists teach us is that barring collusion, the market produces what is reasonable. That's what the economists tell us. But this is an area in which I confess I proceed with the greatest hesitancy. Now, I think it's important to recognize, keep in mind, if I may alter it, when we're discussing the 11th Amendment, that the first question that was presented here is really a misstatement of the issue. And I mean no disrespect, of course, when I say that. The first question presented was whether the 11th Amendment prohibits an award of attorney's fees against a state based on current hourly rates, which include interest and a delay in payment factor. Well, current hourly rates here, there's nothing in this record to suggest that they include interest. I've never heard of a current hourly rate which includes interest. When Your Honors were at the bar, I rather imagine that you didn't have that concept in mind. Certainly there's nothing in this record on it. And equally, current hourly rates do not include a delay in payment factor. Most lawyers like to be paid very, very promptly. And they don't build a delay in payment factor into their current hourly rates.
Right, but they don't charge the rates of 10 years from now either.
10 years prospectively, you mean?
Right. I mean, that's what happens. What is happening here? I mean, by the time recovery is obtained, the rates being charged are the rates of 5 years after the time the services were performed.
Whatever the numbers, that is correct. That is correct. And Judge Clark said that he was looking at the delay in payment factor. I said before, if I may interrupt myself, Justice Scalia, I said before that he treated Arthur Benson differently from the rest. What he did with Mr. Benson was to say that on the basis of skill and experience in the Kansas City current practices, Mr. Benson's current hourly rate ought to be $175, but that he was going to give him an enhancement to $200 an hour because of three factors. One was the fact that Mr. Benson was precluded during this representation from representing anyone else. He couldn't accept any other clients for a period of 2.5 years or something like that. In effect, he bet his professional life on this case, and as the record reveals, he went into debt to the extent of $600,000+. So, all right, Judge Clark thought that that was a factor appropriate to be recognized. The next was the unpopularity of the case, and Judge Clark thought referred to newspaper editorials and newspaper stories and letters to the press and letters to the court denouncing this case. Mr. Benson became a pariah, and Judge Clark thought that that was a factor that might be taken account of in setting a fair rate. And finally, he thought that the delay in payment should be considered. He didn't allocate anything for each of these factors particularly. He just said, taking everything together, he thought $200 was an appropriate fee. I don't see that as any award of interest. If you split the $25, which is 14% enhancement, three ways to account for the three factors, that would be about 5% for a delay of several years. I've never seen an interest table that gave you less than 1% in interest. On the subject of being a pariah and proper compensation for that fact, let me call to the court's attention something that, to me, as a veteran of some class actions, strikes me as significant. This was a class action. There were class action plaintiffs available by the probably hundreds of thousands. Every black school kid in Kansas City was a potential plaintiff. The extraordinary thing about this litigation is that not one lawyer in Kansas City or anybody else stepped forward to join in this case. If it had been an antitrust case, if the Hyatt Hotel had collapsed, if a Securities Act case, there would have been hordes of lawyers coming in saying, I want a piece of the pie. Nobody joined Arthur Benson. He remained alone until the Legal Defense Fund came to join him. I think that, too, is worthy of consideration, and so did Judge Clark. Now, I think that's about really all I have to say or need to say on the question of the way Judge Clark treated this. Taking everything into account, he thought $200 was fair. I don't see any reason why the 11th Amendment stands in the way of that kind of setting of a reasonable fee. It seems to me totally responsive to the statutory command. Now, I think that it might be appropriate to mention that the use of current rates in billing, in the experience of all of us, conforms to the practice of the profession. I've never seen, I don't think any member of this court has ever seen, a bill which read something like, for services performed in 1987 at 1987 rates, dollars X, for services performed in 1988 at 1988 rates, dollars Y, and for services performed in 1989 at 1989 rates, dollars whatever. I might kick myself for having waited so long to render a bill, but I think that the uniform practice of the bar when it renders bills is to bill them out at current rates.
I'm not sure that's right, Mr. Topka. Say somebody goes into the office and says, what do you charge an hour? And the lawyer quotes him an hourly rate and nothing else is said. and then the matter takes 4 years to conclude, would not the client expect to be billed at the rate he was told when he went into the front door?
I would think in that case, yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. Now, one final observation on this point, and that is this. As I've said, while this date record contains no data specific to Kansas City, it is clear that in the Midwest generally, market rates in the period with which we are concerned did not keep pace with inflation. Our expert on rates, Mr. Weil, testified to that effect without contradiction. And I said that the circumstances of this case make it particularly appropriate to recognize the delay in payment. Mr. Benson went into personal debt to the extent of $633,000 to fund this case. And he paid $113,000 in interest by December 31, 1986. He was continuing to pay interest at the rate of $5,000 a month. For the legal defense fund, the case was a near disaster. I'm proud to be a member of the board of the organization, we experienced deficits which we had never experienced before in 1983 and 1984 because of the burden of this case. Now, the state says, of course, that we should be happy with historical rates. But as I've mentioned, the state put in no evidence of historical rates, so we don't know whether to be happy or not. And I may say that so far as the record reveals, the 1987 current market rates, which Judge Clark used, were the same as or higher than rates in 83 or 84. I don't know. We don't know. There's no evidence. Now, what the state would apparently like is for this court to remand so that we could have a trial on that issue. Well, the state had its chance, I respectfully suggest. This court has said, so many of the lower courts have echoed, that we mustn't allow these fee controversies to become second Jarndyce against Jarndyce litigation. That's the very real danger with which we deal. And so I say on the 11th Amendment, we wind up like this. There was no award here of interest. There was no dollar or percentage award or adjustment for delay in payment. There was only a recognition by the trial judge that there had been great delay in payment and an attempt to deal with that by using current rather than historical rates to award reasonable fees. Now, I don't think I need trouble the court with a review of the legal authorities. Your honors are doubtless infinitely more familiar with them than I am. Just a final word or two on the question of paralegals. If I may stay with the 11th Amendment for just a second. This court has often said that the reason for requiring unmistakably clear language when the Congress sets out to abrogate 11th Amendment protection is so that enormous fiscal burdens, and I quote, shall not be imposed on the states by the Congress without careful thought. That's reasonable enough, but we have here no enormous fiscal burdens. As I've seen, we don't know the historical rates that the state will employ, but the total fee award here for services was only around $3.2 million. So use of historical figures would save the state what? Hundreds of thousands of dollars? I don't know. To the state...
$1 million here, Senator Dirksen's line.
Your Honor...
First thing you know, it adds up to real money.
Right. Nice to see a devotee of the classics. Right. It adds up to real money to two interests, Your Honor, not to the state of Missouri, with all respect. This case, at the very least, is going to involve vast expenditure by the state. The people to whom these hundreds of thousands of dollars or this $1 million will make all the difference in the world are Arthur Benson and the Legal Defense Fund. Thank you very much.
Mr. Farmer, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, just briefly, I'd like to respond to Mr. Takpia's implication that I picked this $15, $20 rate out of the air. In the district court's opinion, and on page 828 of the petition, appendix to the petition for cert, the court says, quote, the court notes that the $80 per hour rate is approximately $15 to $20 higher than the average hourly rate for Kansas City associates in 1982 to 1984. Now, he's talking there about associates of Mr. Benson, but he did specifically find that the hourly rates for the period we're talking about was $15 to $20 difference. Other than that, there's nothing else I need to add other than to say that in terms of a fiscal impact on the state of Missouri, the part of Missouri I come from, $1 million still means something. So.
Mr. Farmer, could I ask you about where you draw the line with respect to the principle you're talking about, that the 11th Amendment requires us to interpret statutes strictly against state liability? I mean, I can understand that where the question is, are states covered by this statute or are they not covered? But once you know that the state is covered, every single issue of law that comes up in the interpretation of that statute, we have to interpret in favor of the state unless Congress has made its intent unalterably clear. So, for example, we should interpret attorney's fees not to cover fees for counselors at law in those states where they're not called attorneys? That can't be right. I mean,
admittedly, Your Honor, it's a difficult analysis.
So where do you stop? Why should I go along with you as far as you want to go to say that you can't get interest?
Well, we think you should go as far as we want to take you in this case because it is almost identical to the situation in Library of Congress versus Shaw. In that case, Title VII waived the federal government's sovereign immunity for attorney's fees and costs, but not for interest. And similarly, in this case, while Section 1988 waives 11th Amendment immunity for attorney's fees and costs, but also not interest. And Huddle versus Finney applies Section 1988 to the states, but even Huddle recognizes that if you expand the traditional concept of cost, then that analysis would not apply. I'm not sure there's any easy answer to your question. It's a difficult analysis, but I think in this case the principles in Shaw are completely applicable to the 11th Amendment context.
Thank you, Mr. Farmer. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next number.